Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported by King Bean Coffee Roasters. Located in Charleston, South Carolina, King Bean has been in the business of coffee for more than 20 years. And they're especially known for creating specialty roasts for some of your favorite Charleston eateries, including past guest Callie's Biscuits of Hot Little Biscuit and Margaret Furness of Caviar and Bananas. In 2010, King Bean started offering retail options. In 2014, they launched an online store, and now there is local pickup for those in the Lowcountry. Charleston locals can put in a special code for pickup instead of shipping. And whether you're local or out of town, a visit to kingbean.com can have you sipping coffee roasted in Charleston in no time. They're even anticipating adding a coffee store at their roastery in late 2017. So, for more information on it all, that website, once again, is kingbean.com. Each year, the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival is a magical place. And not just for food and beverages and chef interactions, but for straight-up serendipitous events. Just a few weeks ago, I was enjoying a Friday afternoon cocktail class at the festival when I heard a familiar voice. A voice from a woman who seemed knowledgeable and curious and extremely specific in her line of questioning. I was seated near Christian Lauterbach, famed Atlanta food critic, who has documented the rise of this southern city's food culture through her mail order publication, Knife and Fork. She's also been a voice in Atlanta Magazine for years, and I'd heard that unmistakable French accent first in an episode of Gravy, my favorite food podcast from the Southern Foodways Alliance. Christiane is a critic's critic. And although I don't write reviews and instead cover the culture, folklore, and the people in food, I immediately wanted to ask her about 1,000 questions. Her passion, dedication, and determination to try everything and do things her own way has built her Maverick publication a strong cult following of chefs and those in the know. How does she do what she does? Well, it's simple and yet so complicated. She's never lost her appetite for the next bite.
Welcome to the Southern Fork.
The Southern Fork. I have a publication called Knife and Fork, therefore I should be on the Southern Fork.
That's true, that's true. And first I have to say, we are sitting in a empty conference room right now at the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival.
Okay, because we're sexy and spicy.
That's
and
right.
We make it look all good.
That's right. We're in here, like, quietly doing this. So you can hear the crowds in the background, but you and I obviously are meant to do this because we keep going to the same sessions.
Exactly.
And seeing each other. But I just have to say that I heard about Knife and Fork first from the Gravy episode, which is my favorite Gravy episode. And when I heard you speak yesterday next to me in a cocktail class, I was like, oh, I know that voice. I've listened to it twice.
She has an accent.
Who is that? She's not Southern. Yes, who is that? So let's just go in and talk about the Knife and Fork, because I think about it a lot. And I mentioned this to you off air. I think about it a lot because you had to be personally committed to it. You were doing it whether anybody else cared or not.
Indeed.
And I think about that based on this show, you know, when you start something, that's just kind of that. So what, did you ever think, I'm just not going to do this anymore?
No, I just feel like I'm one of those little animals that are on a treadmill. I don't know how I would even climb out. And I've loved doing that. I was part of a team. I was part of the opening team. There were four of us originally, mm-hmm. including Bill Cutler from Brown's Guide to Georgia, Sue Kreitzman from Sunday Best, and my husband at the time, and myself. And then it's just like an Agatha Christie story. They all kind of dropped away, and it just landed in my lap. And through everything, I simply get doing it because I'm passionate about restaurants.
So how often did it come out for people that aren't familiar?
Once a month.
But these were serious reviews.
And sometimes a little controversial, a little, you know.
Sometimes.
No, one of the things that I love is that in that, it's just like I'm everything. I don't really have anybody limiting what I can say. And it is, I mean, I see Knife and Fork as the great book of Atlanta. I've published it for 37 years now. And everything that has happened in Atlanta is just in there. Some of the archives are at Georgia Tech, where I taught
a class. That must be so fun.
And it still looks so much the way it did. It's just 8 pages, black and white. It comes through the mail. And the secret of Knife and Fork, from the very beginning, 3-hole punch. So I envisioned that people would keep it in a binder. And it feels like incredibly, you know, how am I 100 years old? But it feels great to just be able to look at it as opposed to trying to just find a meme on the internet and whatnot, and people just love it for that.
Well, let's talk about that, because obviously you've had the opportunity to translate this into the digital world. If you wanted to, you could totally do that.
If I wanted to. And I could put pretty pictures, and I could change the type. But I mean, the only reason I do Knife and Fork is because I can do it exactly the way I want to do it. It's very simple. Like, I don't like taking pictures. Food pictures are great for other people. Me, if I wanted to take pictures of cheeseburgers, I would have had a different career. And digitally,
my picture of the hot dog, I took a picture of a hot dog last week that I feel like should be framed, but that's beautiful. Because we're very different.
Yeah, this is definitely not my style. And I just, why would I put it on? People would glance at it. Well, with Knife and Fork, they can.
And it would just be like everything else.
And once in a while, some darling old man just said, my wife wants to clean the basement. Let me give you 37 years of Knife and Fork, which I have accumulated. That makes me so proud. This is what I've wanted. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing story and portrait of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. It's not just blind tasting. It's not just, and sometimes I have themes, you know, the secrets of a particular street. So they are, you know, time I just, like everybody else, I just rush to the new restaurants and I talk about the chefs and all that. But it has that little maverick feeling to you.
Well, I've only spent minutes with you over the last 2 days and I feel like you are a maverick. I think it's really interesting in the age of Yelp where a lot of people are very derisive of everybody's a reviewer, but you came at that.
Yeah.
That's exactly your point. Like, I'm reviewing, so here's my opinion, and that's what Knife and Fork is.
But
is
it's
about.
Not about whether you like or don't like. It's like, if you were an art critic, who cares if you don't like Picasso? It's not about a lot. It's maybe 10% mm-hmm. of. It's, you know, how important is it? You have to put it in the proper context. What was before? How innovative is it? How traditional? And that's not, I mean, the Yelp reviews is like, oh, my girlfriend had an extra chicken wing. It's like, they treated me badly. This is not this is not what I do.
This is looking at it from an artistic perspective within a larger canon, which is Atlanta food scene.
Exactly. And a real context, and the chefs I've been following for years, and, you know, and Maverick, I just, you know, chefs say, oh, when will you come to my restaurant? It's like, you never know when I'm going to come to your restaurant.
That's right.
One day you'll find me sitting at your bar, and I'll be eating, and you won't know what I think until a month from then.
Well, let's talk about how you choose, since it is only 8 pages, and you do now have a pretty good following, I'm just saying. How do you decide who makes those 8 pages every month?
Just follow my own personal interest. I mean, there are restaurants that you could not review. For example, when Annie Quattrano moves Bacchanalia to a new location, of course I'm going to be there, I'm passionate about it. So there are places that write themselves in the publication. Right. And otherwise, you know, I have my own specialized interests. Sometimes some of, particularly at the beginning, some of our subscribers were less interested in Koreatown and Korean food than I was. And but also follow whatever opens is fair game. Is that going to make a good story?
Right. So you eat a lot more than what makes those 8 pages every month. Of yes. Course, and absolutely. I think a lot of people need to know that, you know, with reviewers. I mean, reviewing is an art style. It's a style of writing, and it's an approach to a restaurant, which is different than just going to eat. Beaufort Highway is iconic now in the South. I mean, I knew about it before I ever visited, and you know, it's so fun to go and like test and treat your taste buds to these things that, frankly, you can't get in a lot of other southern cities, even today.
Except I was just in Houston, and I was fascinated by the fact that Bel Air Boulevard is really, it makes Beaufort Highway feel kind of improvised. But I'm glad we're talking
about By the way, Beaufort Highway is very improvised. But I was bringing that up because I think that you were part of the reason it became bigger.
Yeah, I felt for a while there was, I mean, enormous enthusiasm. I mean, it started, I mean, it was just a kind of a silly artery where you went to get, you know, a new muffler or stuff like that. It was very automotive, but also there were cheap apartments and there was a lot of construction in the 80s and Mexicans came to do construction and they started just doing fairly improvised places, and that was the very beginning. And the thing that is tremendously unusual about Beaufort Highway is that that mix of ethnicities. A lot of times cities have a particular Chinatown and a Koreatown and a Mexican town. And in Atlanta, people have really shared, sometimes uneasily, but people have shared the real estate. So you have next to one another, you will have a Dominican restaurant that does breakfast, and then you will have a wonderful Vietnamese place next to it. And the Koreans are mostly outside the perimeter. So for a while, I felt, you know, Atlanta just saw Beaufort Highway as, you know, becoming a little seedy in some ways, particularly some of the side arteries. Mm-hmm. And all the money just went to Duluth. Pleasant Hill, for me, was the new Beaufort Highway. Mm-hmm. It was incredible density of businesses. But now people are putting money again into Beaufort Highway. Part of it is the city of Doraville and the city of Chamblee. I think they got some federal grant money, and now they are just improving also the real estate, so it's more attractive to be there. They just put some new lights. There are great plans for Beaufort Highway, including maybe making it bike-friendly, which I'm not sure.
Sounds really scary.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the fact that it was very unplanned. Just people simply just were piled on top of one another, doing little places, and sometimes like definitely under the radar, sometimes a little questionable. But to me, it's a fascinating world. And now a couple of really brand new restaurants have brought back some of the excitement and glamour to Beaufort Highway. There's a brand new Asian place called Food Terminal, so it's not scary to Americans. Food Terminal, I've heard of a Food Terminal. It's beautiful, international food. It feels like you're in Asia, you're in Kuala Lumpur, you are at a train station. It's the hustle and the bustle is back on Beaufort Highway, so I'm excited about that.
Ah, well, I was going to ask, what are you excited about? And I didn't have to ask, so that's really great. But when you are doing this over the multiple decades, you have to grow your palate, because as you taste, like, I've never had a Malaysian restaurant food. So then you have to taste and know how that tastes based on something that you've had before, or a taste memory in that. How do you do that? And then do you take notes for yourself?
Oh, I never take notes. I'm just not organized enough. When I eat, I eat. And if I'm still alive by the time I come home, I may take a couple of notes on the computer. But, my position is if I don't remember it, maybe it's not worth remembering. So
I said that first. Did you steal that from me?
I did not steal it.
I've always said people say, you don't take notes. And I say, no, if I can't remember your dish in a festival, then it's not worth remembering. So I'll take pictures sometimes for reference, but for the most part, like, I will remember because I can remember what I had 10 years ago on a Tuesday sometimes.
Yeah, it may not be quite as good, but the thing that is interesting, I run into chefs all the time and they remember what I ate when I was there. And I'm like, really? So, but I do remember the taste. In order to review, you know, sometimes I will declare myself as a pretty innocent person, but a lot of time I also have my local experts. I have good friends in various communities. I have Indian friends. I have friends from Hong Kong. I have, you know, a friend from Hong Kong who married a Malaysian woman. He knows everything about Malaysian food. But authenticity, you know, be damned at some level, is that how pleasurable it is. I think the word authentic can be a little questionable. What we don't want is something thoroughly Americanized. Though there's a brand new restaurant that just opened in Decatur, which is to us almost like Berkeley is to San Francisco. And it is an homage to the Americanized Chinese restaurant.
Which I grew up on and love. Like I'm going to have to confess.
Confess.
I really love chicken chow mein. Like, I know it doesn't really exist, but I grew up eating like a number one with an extra wonton soup. You know, my sister and I would split that. And so now when it's rainy and cold on like an early November day, I hit that Chinese takeout for number one chicken chow mein.
That's interesting. I mean, me, I've become completely not corrupted, but I'm passionate about the regional Chinese cuisine. I mean, I really love Cantonese food, which is very mild, but I also love Sichuan food, which is at the opposite end.
Yes.
And I think that the Chinese restaurants have gotten a bad rap in Atlanta. Some of them, I think, are very good. It's not a community that is as cohesive as the Korean community, where they all participate in the same culture. Here you have the Cantonese people, the Hong Kong people, who hardly talk to the Taiwanese people, and then they look at the newer arrival from Fujian, and they are like, wow, those are bad people. So it's interesting. And also, really, one thing about Beaufort Highway is there is not much of a drinking scene, not much of a evening scene, so it makes it great for families to bring people around, but economically, it's difficult to just really make.
Alcohol really helps restaurants maintain a consistent bottom line so that they can experiment in the food that has – a lot of people don't realize how tight margins are in restaurants.
Absolutely.
And alcohol helps you create a little more wiggle room for your chefs.
The Koreans have a big drinking scene, I would have to say. But it's also expensive to secure a full liquor license. It's really –
right.
You know, you have to spend – a ton of money just simply securing the proper permits and all that. And I went to a restaurant not that long ago, and I would have to say it was a really crappy little room. And I went to the back thinking, maybe there's another room that is more special. And I walked past, and it was a very untidy bedroom. There was just like bed stuff. I mean, clearly they just sleep right there next to.
Oh, my goodness.
And I don't particularly, you know, when I write something like that in Knife and Fork, I'm like, oh, am I going to get them in trouble? But I think, I don't think that the housing authority or the chief of police read my publication.
Maybe they do. But let me get back to that first part of that question, where is how do we expand our palates? I ask that all the time on the Southern Fork because I think it's one of the most important ways to enjoy food. It's an adventurous thing.
I can see that. I mean, I've always had an extraordinary curiosity for various tastes. I grew up in Paris. You see stuff, you walk in the street, and there are windows full of amazing things. And I was maybe 7 or 8, and I saw white food. Like, French food is not very white, and this was Heart of Palm. And I just remember I became obsessed with tasting Heart of Palm. How does it taste?
And then you were terribly disappointed.
No, I do like Heart of Palm. I was not disappointed at all. So I think I simply maintain a baseline of eating weird stuff all around the clock. And also, it was in a while, some people in the international community will invite me, some personal friends. So I discover a new spice. That, you know, something magic to me is something that I have not tasted before.
Right.
We were just at similar classes.
Isn't that so fun?
Like, I'm now growing a curry plant. Curry leaf just has such an amazing fragrance. It just smells beautifully. It tastes so different from many things. So I keep adding. It's just like I have an encyclopedic mind. I just want to accumulate as many also primary ingredients. I want to see how it tastes by itself so that I can recognize it in something else.
So you come at it really from a scientific way.
Or from an like explorer. I feel sometimes I'm kind of like Audubon, you know, I want to catalog all the birds.
It's
like,
duck,
duck, goose, goose, duck. And I just simply...
But no pictures. He did pictures. You don't do pictures.
I'm not particularly visual. And when chefs say, oh, you first eat with your eyes, I'm always kind of cringing because I feel, if it looks like a bucket of mud, it may be terrific. I don't know if you were at the hash class.
Wrote on hash last year for Food Republic.
Exactly, it looks like a bucket of goop. And I just think it's fascinating.
It is kind of a bucket of goop.
Yeah. So sometimes I do not just exist by knife and fork alone. I've been writing for Atlanta Magazine for a very, very long time. And at various times in my career, you know, young, wonderful editor will ask me, what is the most photogenic dish? And it makes me screech. It's like, I don't care if it is not photogenic. It's like, I don't eat for that purpose. Mm-hmm. If the best dish in the restaurant looks like a bucket of mud, let's go for it. But tasting everything, and I'm a big forager. I like to taste so many things. When you know the primary taste, it tells you a lot about how to organize it in order to see what a dish is.
Right.
And I shop in ethnic groceries. It's very rare. Sometimes I need toilet paper. Sometimes. So I'll have to go to like a regular store. But otherwise, I shop in some very bizarre
sketchy places.
Yes, I do.
Do you consider yourself a cook?
Well, you know, I've been married twice. And I have cooked.
High five.
You know, I have entertained, in terms of cooking, and I raised two lovely children, so cooking doesn't relax me. And in terms of cooking, I'm interested in stuff that takes 3 minutes or stuff that takes 3 days. Like, it's the middle thing that I'm not crazy about. Mm-hmm. So it's not relaxing for me, but I would be, for example, an amazing prep cook because I have a lot of technique. I know how to remove the membranes from a brain and how to remove the skin from a green walnut and I can dice and chop, but it's the cooking on the line. And if I cook something that takes a very long time, by the time I'm supposed to serve it, like, I don't even want to look at it. So I don't know that I'm an ambitious, inspired cook. I can cook in my head.
But you're a good eater.
Yes.
Yes, an enthusiastic eater.
And when I cook, it's good. It's good when I cook, but I don't do it that often.
So what are you still excited about that you haven't tasted that you are wanting to learn? So you just had the curry leaf plant, which I've had, but I wouldn't say that I fell in love with it enough to grow it because you don't want to bring a plant into my house right now. they start to scream when they see my front door. Is there something that is just like, I haven't explored that at all?
Well, every once in a while I hear something, you know, new, even here. I'm like, what? Stack cake? I've never heard of that. I must go to that class, see what it is.
So yes.
Even in my own backyard.
Hey, Travis Milton.
Hey, Travis Milton. It was not Travis Milton.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
Passionate, rambling. It was definitely, I was trying to squeeze some kind of a recipe out of him, and he was like, into the romance. And I loved him for that.
Right.
So even in my own backyard, there's stuff all the time that I've never heard, heard of. And that is the impulse. I had it as a young child. And I really feel uniquely suited to be somebody who writes about restaurants. I could never have been a wine writer. I don't think I have the receptors. I mean, I've had access to extraordinary wine, amazing old vintage port, great Chateau de Cam, etc. And I totally, I love it, I enjoy it. I don't think I have the vocabulary. I don't think I have the memory, the specific taste memory. I may not remember what I ate last Tuesday, but you build, I mean, how do you develop your palate? For example, a tomato, every tomato contributes to your knowledge of what an ideal tomato should be. You know, maybe that one was a little too hard, that one was a little too squishy. So you keep cattle, I mean, it's kind of having an enormous
And you catalog. Have an idea what your ideal tomato is.
It develops over
a long
period.
It develops.
Yes, you don't
and
know it at first.
What is fun
yes.
is when that ideal is popped on its head when you try something
yeah.
else. You know, so you say, like for me, like I love Cherokee purple tomatoes. Mm-hmm. I love those tomatoes. But there might be a tomato out there that yeah. I haven't tried
right.
that I might like more.
Exactly. That's the difference also between you
for
and
sure.
everything. They're an expert, but they have, I can guarantee you that unless they are tomato growers, they may not have eaten as many tomatoes in many different countries, in many
right.
iterations. So this is super, super interesting to me to mm-hmm. catalog multiple tastes. That's how I feel my palate is expanding all the time. But I have a concern sometimes about living in America in the 21st century and chefs being so blasted with flavors. I think the word flavor is one of the words that I do not like. Like if I'm going to buy hummus, or make hummus, I'm not going to use sun-dried tomato, roasted garlic, whatever. I want my hummus to taste like hummus. So I have a bias also for simplicity at times.
Mm-hmm.
But then when a chef does something extraordinarily abstract, I can be passionate about that as
mm-hmm.
well. But this blasting of flavor, and
right.
like I love Sean Brock, but I think he can be like, boom,
mm-hmm.
massive amount of like flavors that me would send me like, really,
right.
really.
So you enjoy
backward.
The more subtle, clean flavors.
Clean is important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of time I don't like looking at food pictures because to me they look kind of like eek.
Right.
They're glistening in a weird way or it's
well,
just not interesting to me.
One of the things that I'm on right now is menus that aren't edited or dishes that aren't edited. It's, you know, I can't really say anything because I'm an accessories person. So I like to, like, wear rings and necklace and earrings and hair things and stuff. But I always heard that, like, Coco Chanel said, you should put all that on
yeah,
and then take one
yeah.
off or two off.
Yeah.
And I feel like we miss that sometimes in dishes nowadays. Like, if it takes somebody 10 minutes to explain, maybe you need to take it down one.
Yeah, I think that spices can be troublesome
mm-hmm.
because spices, like in some food culture, like in Indian culture, the spices are ground and roasted and just sprinkled in the right way. Here, you know, I'm not that interested in a chef who wants to put a ton of smoked peppers or whatnot. It's like it doesn't feel indigenous. It doesn't feel urgent to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, I see that. And
I like that word, urgent. That's good. I think you're a writer.
Really?
You think?
Yeah,
she
pinched
think?
Me. I want you all to know she just pinched me. Stephanie pinched me. And I've been trained. I can't say ouch.
That's right. That's right. Well, on that note, I have just pinched someone that I have admired for 30 years. So actually not 30 years. I haven't known she's existed for 30 years, but she's been writing for more than 30 years. And I just pinched
Indeed.
This woman. So I'm going to end on that since I'm blushing horribly. But if people want to learn more about Knife and Fork and about the Atlanta food scene and about the great work that this woman does, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. We'll have pictures, hopefully, at least one, and a link or two to Atlanta Magazine so you can see some of her work. And if you like what you hear, it's a party of one at the Southern Fork. We are putting out podcasts every week. And it would be lovely if you subscribed or put a review on iTunes because I get to do this every week. I get to talk to somebody that I admire and ask them questions and pick their brain. So thank you so much for allowing me to have the opportunity to do that. And thank you so much, Krishan, for being
here. Thank you, Stephanie. And when you see a fork in the road, take it.
Yay!
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?